This is the Out of Water Podcast. Out of Water is a production of Rio Vista Community Church in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. If you like what you hear, please subscribe and tell a friend to help them find Out of Water also.
Welcome, folks, to another episode of the Out of Water Podcast. My name is Sam. I'll be your host today. Joining me is Will.
Back in the saddle.
Back in the saddle after a couple of Kasten Smiths filling in for the last commandment on parenting and honoring your parents, and then had a special guest, Leah, and a number of you sent really kind emails for her, which I appreciate. I think it means a lot to her, and part of the reason why I want to do that, honestly, is to get her used to speaking out and defending her faith and speaking like, this is mine, I own it. And so thanks for indulging us to let that episode happen. I think it really like made an impact on her. It was a big deal for her. It's cool.
Good. I haven't listened to it yet, so I would compliment.
Leah, we're sorry.
Sorry.
Anyway, today we're getting into a podcast that might actually take two episodes because we're dealing with the sixth commandment, and there's so many different strands of the sixth commandment to chase down and to discuss it thoroughly. But it's do not murder, right? Like it, and the in the Hebrew, it's really just two words. It comes from lo, which is do not. It's a very strong, emphatic, like do not do this. And then the word ratzach, which is murder. And there's some interesting things about that word, just like before we even get down the road, because a lot of people out of the gates are going to be like, okay, this is a general blanket that says you are not allowed to take life of anything. You know, like I've seen ads where PETA, you know, is quoting this commandment in relation to not eating animals or something like that.
Because that's a KJV thing, right? Because I think they use kill instead of
correct.
Murder. So kill could be picking a plant out of the ground. I technically...
Yeah, you're taking the life of it, yeah. But this is not this word. Like, if you understand the original Hebrew, which, you know, we have an obligation to do our, you know, diligence when we're translating, because that's what God is originally giving. That word, ratzach, is only ever used for humankind. And there's a very strong connotation that it's an unjust taking of life. Almost always, that's the idea. But when the Bible is talking about capital punishment, which there's lots of that in the Old Testament, it's different words. There's actually four different Hebrew words that are used for killing. You have harag, you have mut, and you have a katal. But ratzach is altogether different. It communicates like you are doing this out of an unjust sense. You're taking a life that the Bible gives no sanction for you to take.
And that changes things.
That drastically changes things.
Gets shortened.
Yeah. So where does this commandment, where does it come from? Because you can go through. Here's something that we kind of arrogantly assume is like, of course everybody's going to be opposed to killing. But you go through history and you find all sorts of different cultures, when it's not rooted ultimately in the Judeo-Christian roots, that come up with all kinds of different standards of who's worthy to live. You know, you go to ancient Sparta, and what do they do when they have sickly kids?
Exposure, right?
Yeah, I mean, they would throw them off cliffs. If you go to the ancient Roman world, they would do exposure, where it's like, oh, I don't want this kid. Sometimes they would just straight up kill the kid because it was the choice of the dad or the parents. Other times they would say, well, I don't want to kill it, so I'll leave it out to exposure and let the child bake to death in the sun, and that way I don't have to say that I killed it. You know, the gods allowed the child to die. Or I mean, there's a million different things like that. You go back in ancient history and there's numerous cultures that actually slaughtered their children or did human sacrifice or the sacrifice of virgins. And it was seen as a noble thing to take a life unjustly without cause. The person had done nothing wrong. And so this idea that we're just naturally built with, you know, we're built with a self-interest to live, you know, a truck's coming at you, you'll move out of the way if you have sense about you. Like, we want to preserve our own life, but you can't take for granted that all cultures throughout all of time have had the same view of life that we have. And in a culture that's now increasingly post-Christian, the reason why we have such a high value of life still is really just the hangover of those Judeo-Christian values, thankfully, that we still have. They're the after impact of those Judeo-Christian values. But there's a lot of ways that you see those starting to slip. You know, in the 1970s, we saw that with Roe v. Wade, where we said that an unborn child, you know, for instance, does not have a right to live. Or you see it in Canada with the laxing of euthanasia laws, where if you're sickly, you should have the right to take your own life. And in our culture, you can feel like, well, yeah, why shouldn't you be able to do that? You know, this is my choice. And it all comes down to that, where the biblical ethic is that you do not belong to yourself. No life belongs to you. You have absolutely no right, unless it's a matter of justice, whereby God commissions a government with the authority to take life, and he does that in the scriptures. You, as an individual, have zero right to take another life unless it's in self-defense, period. And we're losing that ethic. But where does that ethic come from?
Right here.
It's the law. Like, we're okay, you're commanded, do not murder, period.
Oh, the image of God.
That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't belong to yourself, but the entire ethic of why human life is so valuable comes from the truth that you are made in his image. You bear the imago Dei. And so, therefore, you have no authority to take life, because it doesn't, one, it doesn't belong to you, but two, it bears the image of something that's extraordinarily sacred. And when you take a life and you destroy the imago Dei, it is an affront directly to God. You know, it's like, I was thinking about this when I was in the car ride here today. Like, if I gave someone a gift, let's say that I made, like, you know, I bought my dad one of those photos that's contained in crystal. It looks like glass, but it's like carved in the inside. I don't understand how they do it, but it's pretty cool looking.
Did you do that recently?
A couple of years ago. Okay. But it was like, I did it with the family. You know, my mom was sickly. Okay. So I got one of all the family and put it together for her. And it's now on his, you know, TV credenza or whatever. But if I did that and I gave it to him and it was just an image of me, which would be really
pretty, that'd be awesome.
It'd be pretty. Hey, here's a picture.
I'm going to get you one
in
of you
glass
for your desk.
That'd be amazing. But if somebody came over to him and now that's his property, right? It belongs to him, and they took it and they threw it and smashed it into a million pieces. One, it would be an offense to him because he owns it, right?
It's just rude.
But who's it in? Why would they do that? Like, if it's my image that's in the glass.
Well, they hate Sam, obviously.
Correct. So you see where I'm going with this?
Yeah.
Like, you bear the image of God. And so if somebody comes and destroys you, one, your life doesn't belong to yourself. So even in the glass analogy, like, your life belongs to God and you bear his image. And so when somebody destroys another life, you are taking what rightfully only belongs to God, one. And then two, you're taking something that bears his image and expressing the hatred and anger toward him, because whatever you're destroying, he created, one, it belongs to him, and it bears his image. It's offensive in his sight.
That's good. And also, the Bible has a lot to say about our physical bodies. So murder is the ultimate destruction of a physical body. Like, your body's a temple, like, take care of it. So it's the ultimate offense to then say, oh, but your body, your actual physical body, I know the soul and the image of God, but also the physical body matters.
That's completely, like, you are a temple. All of it is talking about life in terms that are extraordinarily sacred, right? Like, it gives so much dignity to humanity. And to all of humanity. It's not just kings, right? You know, it used to be in the ancient world that you would have a king that would separate himself apart and say, I am God on earth, and you must listen to me because I am God on earth. Well, Christianity comes and it kind of levels everything, because it says now the most vulnerable, the poorest, the farthest outcast, the most marginalized, they all bear the image of God. So it's not one man who sets himself apart like a Pharaoh or a Babylonian king saying, I speak on behalf of the gods or I am God. Now, all of a sudden, all of these people, whether they're believers or not, it doesn't matter whether you're a Christian or not, you are made in the image of God. You have extraordinary dignity, extraordinary dignity. And so when you do it, like what you're talking about, you're not only taking the image of God, the property of God, but then he says for believers, you're the temple of God. You are sacred property. Like, do not defile that with your behavior or when someone else comes and does something violent or murderous against you. Like, we do not do a good enough job categorizing how important the protection and the sanctity of human life is for all the other commandments, right? Why don't you steal? Why don't you commit adultery? Why don't you covet? Why don't you do all those things? It's because humans have dignity, and you owe dignity to humanity. You can't just steal their stuff as though they don't matter. You can't just talk about them and slander them and lie about them and do all those things as though they don't matter, because they bear the image of God. That is so important for the whole second half of the Ten Commandments. We talked about how the first four were all about God and how we honor him, and the last six are how we treat each other. Well, if you genuinely believe that all of your neighbors bear the stamp of God's image, it changes the gravity with how you relate to one another, doesn't it?
Yeah, day to day would be much different.
Yeah, you're dealing with the image of God. You'd better treat them a little bit differently, kinder, with respect, with reverence even, with some sacred character to that. And so as that fades away, if you're nothing but, you know, what the world tells you, where we live in this naturalistic world where there's absolutely nothing sacred about you because you're just cells holding hands and dancing around to their DNA, why are you valuable? Why does your life matter? If you don't do anything good for me or for the world, why are you not expendable? Like, what makes you innately valuable? And that's why you look at a world right now where you've got, it seems like the insane asylum, where you get people like PETA who says animals and humanity are just as valuable as one another. Well, if there's no Imago Dei, why not? If Darwin's right and we're just naturalists, why? I mean, that makes total sense. But it shows you that when you start walking away from the Ten Commandments, from this idea that this is a sacred obligation that's binding on all of humanity because you bear the image of God, why would you value life? Why are all those people that are on the progressive side of the spectrum, and I put progressive in quotes there, why are they not wrong that a salamander has the same value and dignity as you do? I can't answer that.
No, the Ten Commandments change things.
I mean, the only answer that I can give you is that because I'm a human, selfishly, we should be more important. but if I have no reference point to say, well, no, we were set apart and we were made for God and we were made in his image and we were made to be set apart in a special relationship with him, and we bear all the dynamics of the Imago Dei, well, like, that would set us apart. We take all that away, and it's just, I mean, your toilet paper.
Yeah, you could argue that you have value in what you produce, but then that also is the argument: when I stop producing, well, then I am expendable.
That's it.
So I mean, that's not a good option either in
the
my
utilitarian
life.
Approach, what you're talking about. Like, I mean, that was Germany, you know, where it's like, okay, they stop producing, they're no longer valuable. Get rid of the weak, get rid of the infirmed, get rid of the poor. Those were the ethics that, if you go back into ancient history, all of the great philosophers of antiquity are writing stuff like that. Let the poor die. You do a disservice by giving a beggar food. You just prolong his life for misery. Like, these are famous people that come to the table with those kinds of ethics. Then Jesus comes into the world, and you have a man who actually is God, unlike Pharaoh or the Babylonian kings. And what does he do? He doesn't come saying, I am God. Unbelievably, he comes and says, I don't count equality with God something to be grasped. And he pours himself out as a servant, and he relates to the lowest among us to extend dignity to the lowest among us. Like, if you want to know, like, the ethics of Christianity that just ooze out of the Bible, it is life over death. God is always bringing life and flourishing to triumph over death and withering in everything, not just your physical life, not just your eternal life, not just in your marriages and your hopes and your work and all of that stuff. He's bringing beauty, life, and flourishing in place of withering, death, and everything else. But in addition to that, God comes and says, I relate to the slave. I relate to the outcast. I relate to the one that nobody wants. And thereby, if God relates to them, what happens? They're infused with unbelievable dignity. And if you went to the first century, so I love this stuff, like the demographics of the first and second and third centuries after Jesus, who was it that came to the faith in droves?
It was all those people.
All those people. So you, like if you go to first, second, third century Roman civilization, the church was overwhelmingly women. Why would that be?
Outcasts.
For the first time, you have somebody who comes and says, you bear the image of God. You have dignity. You're not just a property of your husband. Like, you matter. And all the slaves came in droves. Like, the church was made fun of by the nobles of Roman society for being filled with people that were slaves, women, fools, all the poor of society. They flocked to the church because it gave dignity. Everybody bears the imago Dei. Where the Romans, the elites, the men, the nobles, the wealthy, at least initially, what was their perspective? Well, we already have it all.
Yeah, I don't need that.
I mean, I'm at the top of the food chain, so... And it was a utilitarian ethic that was really gross. And Christianity turned the world upside down.
And Rome was a pretty wicked place, so when morals get involved, they were pretty much like, ah.
Yeah, it was whatever's good for the top. I mean, that was it. Yeah, you're right, totally. And this one is like, this is one of those commandments beyond this, like in our day and age, and I think probably for most cultures that you go back and you look at legal codes that are created, almost every legal code in history, I can't think of one that doesn't have this, is going to say you're not allowed to just go around and indiscriminately kill. Like, murder's always going to be in legal codes. But this, what's interesting, and by the way, if you ask people to name the Ten Commandments, this one always, this is always like, oh yeah, do not murder, and you know, we don't know our Ten Commandments very well. But this one, everybody knows. Like, we don't kill. We don't want to be in a society where we kill. And this is also a commandment that is made very clear right out of the gates. This is one of the more famous sins that when Cain murdered his brother Abel, right? And God institutes punishment. He's banished from where they live. Like, there's a very, very clear consequence. Then you get to Genesis 9, and I actually want to look at this. But when God is, so the flood is over, God is giving a covenant of mercy to Noah and his children, and society's about to be, you know, restarted. Here's the birth certificate charter of the post-flood world in chapter 9 of Genesis. And God comes to them and says, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. So he's repeating everything that he told Adam and Eve. Like, I still want you to be, I want you to have kids. I want you to have big families. I want you to bring forth what? Life. And I want you to spread all over the earth, and I want you to fill it, and I want you to bring beautiful life and the garden design all over the earth. And he says, you're going to basically, you're going to reign over all of the creatures. Everything that lives shall be food for you. So sorry, PETA, but like, God gives permission to eat animals. It's okay, right? And as I gave you green plants, I give you everything. But he says, you shall not eat flesh with its life. That is its blood. In other words, it's got to be cooked. You're not eating the blood of something. And so blood is now being set apart as this really precious thing. And he says in verse 5, and for your lifeblood, which, you know, in the translation in the ESV, that's one word, but it's literally two words that are being merged together there. So you have the word for nefesh, which is soul. It's your life. It can be translated breath. It can be translated like your neck. But it's nefesh is your soul, right? It's your being. It's, you're a living creature. But it throws in with that dam, which is blood. Dam is blood in the Hebrew. And so it connects, your soul and your blood are together, your life blood. So in God's eyes, that is part of what makes life very sacred. It's blood and soul. And so for your lifeblood, I will require a reckoning. From every beast, I will require it, and from man. From his fellow man, I will require a reckoning for the life of man. And then here we go. Here comes the first commandment. He says, whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For God made man in his own image. So long before you get to Exodus chapter 20 and the sixth commandment, you have God saying, of course you're not allowed to murder. Of course there's really, really intense consequences, capital punishment, in fact, for taking a life. Why? Because man is made in God's image.
And it really gives you a picture that was important for God to rehash with Noah right after the flood. So you can imagine pre-flood what kind of world that was.
Yeah, a lot of it.
He seemed really fixed on being like, okay, I got to rehash this with them. They seem to have forgotten it.
Yeah. I want life to abound. I want beauty in this world. There cannot be the murderous rampage where you see before the flood where, you know, you got Lamech saying, I'm going to avenge anybody who harms me 70 times, seven times. You know, like he's like, I'll murder everyone who harms me. It's a very vengeful, nasty world. And so this is where we get into this kind of tightrope of God says, vengeance belongs to me. You, as an individual, apart from self-defense, are not allowed to go on a bloodshedding spree. You're not allowed to pursue your own vengeance. That's why he gives governments. Like, you are required to pursue peace with people if you can help it. And so right after all of that, what does he say? And you, be fruitful and multiply. He repeats it again. Be fruitful and multiply. Increase greatly on the earth and multiply in it. In other words, God is saying, we are not a people of death. We never bring death. We are people of life. We're fruitful. We multiply. We bring life and beauty wherever we go. And that's not just talking about, okay, well, I guess I won't kill anyone. You know, it's, I want to bring life in all of its forms and all of its beauty. And anything that's related to death, apart from justice, is disgusting and reprehensible in his eyes.
Yeah, that's a good take on that. I've never thought about it. That is, it seems like a negative. Like, just don't murder. Just don't take life. Don't cause death. But it is really, no, I love life so much that I want you to pursue that in your own body and to help others pursue life fully. Yeah.
And so, like, when you get to the New Testament and you're in the Sermon on the Mount, let's go there real quick. I think it's
Matthew 5:21.
Way to be ready to go.
I prepped for this. And Jesus really amplifies it here.
Yeah, he's like, you thought that was intense. Like, let me show you what's actually behind this murder requirement. Because when God first kind of like expounds on murder, what's the basis of why you should not murder? He says it in Genesis 9, because you are made in God's image, right? Okay, well then Jesus says, well, let's go a little farther here. Because why does God not want you murdering? Because you are damaging the image of God. It's really sacred. It's really precious. Okay, well, let's dig a little deeper. And Jesus expounds. He says, you've heard it said to those of old, you shall not murder. Well, okay, that's what we're talking about right now. Yeah. And whoever murders will be liable to judgment. He's going all the way back to the law of Sinai and even back to Genesis 9 and the words given to Moses. Like, if you murder, there's justice coming for you. But I say to you, this is Jesus, I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother, and that the translation cleans it up, but it's like if you say raka, which is an ancient Aramaic word that means you are empty. You're nothing. You're a fool. Your head is empty. Your heart is empty. There's nothing to you. You don't matter to me. You mean nothing to me. That's what raka means. It's literally empty-headed. If you say that to your brother, you will be liable to the council, the Sanhedrin, who have authority to recommend death sentences. And he says, and whoever says, you fool, which the word there is moros, which we get moron, you're an idiot. If you say that, you'll be liable to the hell of fire. Whoa. So hang on a minute. Like, that's Jesus, yeah. Now all of a sudden that's creeping up in my backyard because I'm pretty certain I've called lots of people fool.
At least.
And I, in my anger toward others, have thought, you know what? That person doesn't exist to me. They're dead to me. Have you ever said that? Have you ever heard that said? You're dead to me? You know what that means, essentially?
Yeah, I've killed you in my head. Yeah.
You're nothing. You mean nothing to me. I'm not going to give you another moment's thought. I'm not going to concern myself with the fact that you're still alive. Now, I mean, there's obvious things that you do where you're not, you know, putting yourself in situations to be abused and, okay, I need to move on. And that everything that I've done from my perspective to make peace with that person, I've tried, and it only ever ends with bad things. But you can never write a person off and say they don't matter anymore. They're garbage. They're fools, and write them off as though there's no hope of redemption, where you have no imagination of some kind of story that could lead to the redemption of that relationship. Jesus says, that's murder. That's murder. How do you get there? Right? I remember listening to a Tim Keller sermon where, you know, I think it was one of the Ivy League schools where a great literature professor had students read the Sermon on the Mount, right? And of course, we're in a post-biblical culture, so they've never heard any of this stuff before.
So they think it's just like a book.
Yeah,
like,
I mean, this is literature. Like, okay, I'll try this out. Let's check out this guy's ideas. Oh, Jesus, I have heard of him. And they read the Sermon on the Mount, and they universally hate it. They hate it. Like, okay, this is so far-fetched. It's impossible. You can't possibly live by this. You can't turn the other cheek. You can't, you know, if I'm a murderer just for being angry and saying these things, then what hope do we have? And they all feel totally condemned. You know what? They should.
Good.
Right? Like, that's the right response, because none of us can possibly measure up to any of the Ten Commandments. We violated all of them is the idea. But Jesus expands this in a way to where none of us can stand. Mm-hmm. You know, if you say, hey, don't murder. All right, well, I'm good. Like, I've never murdered anybody.
Yeah, a good portion of the population could be like, got it.
Yeah. Check. I mean, some people have, like, literally murdered people. But, you know, I'm not guilty as far as I know. I've never done anything that I know of that's taken another life. Like, who knows? Like, I mean, maybe I threw a burrito out the window and it hit someone driving and wrecked into a tree. I have no idea if I'm responsible for it. I haven't knowingly. By the way, I haven't thrown burritos out the window either.
This is a long explanation for a guy saying he hasn't killed anybody.
People are like, all right, well, why is he taking so long here? What's going
really
on here?
Meandering.
But anyway. So the whole idea is, when we think of life and death, we think like, do they have a heartbeat? You know, are they moving? Are they breathing? And that's life or death. And in the economy of God, there's like such a spectrum of life and death. Like when you go and you tear a person down, what are you doing? You're tarnishing the imago Dei on that person. You're bringing, in a sense, some withering, some dying, you're wrecking relationships. So there's death. The smell of death is in all kinds of sin. What is the wages of sin is what?
Death.
Death. Like, so sin brings naturally this corrupting to the world. The world's already filled with all kinds of death. And God is, you know, our Savior is one who brings a sense of resurrection to things. And it's not just a resurrection on the final day where you get to come out of a grave. He wants to bring resurrection to you right now. And in the New Testament, you find Paul and the apostles talking about that the spirit of resurrection, the same God who rose Jesus from the dead, is at work where?
In us.
In us. And so what does that mean? That means he's in some way, long before we die, if the God of resurrection is at work in us, that means that he's bringing life where dead things are. In all sorts of ways. And so the job of the Christian, like, we're people of resurrection. We want to bring life and flourishing to every environment, to broken relationships, to broken marriages, to broken dreams, to hurting people. Like, we are people that want to see fruitfulness and multiplying and gardens expanding. And when you go to somebody and you say, I hate you, you can just feel death advancing.
Yeah, my mom early on was like, as a kid, she was really against the word hate.
Yeah.
And as a kid, it was confusing. We were only allowed to hate two things.
That's a four-letter word in our house, too.
Yeah, Satan and asparagus. She allowed us to hate both of those. But as an adult, it makes more sense now. Because words like that, man, people use even phrases after someone does something to them that's not physical but could be emotional, like, hey, that just really killed me. Mm-hmm. Like when you said that, it just killed me.
I died inside a little, you know? You feel it. Like, death comes in so many forms. Like when you have someone who is, dearly loved, and they pass away, you'll hear people say, you know, part of me died with them. Mm. I think there's some truth to that. Like, there are elements of this world that are hostile toward life in its fullness. Like when Jesus talks about, you know, I come to bring abundant life and the fullness of life. What does that mean? That means that there's some kind of spectrum that he's talking about. Like, you're supposed to have life to the full. Well, how do you have it partially? You know?
That's true.
That means that death, in some ways, is diminishing what you are and what life is supposed to be in this world. And how does death advance? Well, the Bible tells us, through sin, through abandoning the design of God. Now, some of that you can't control. Like, there's natural stuff that's broken in this world that God eventually is going to make new. But there's a lot that comes from the human heart that is desperately wicked, that needs to die. You want to talk about putting something to death? Start with the flesh and all your selfishness and your own desires and designs that run hostile to God's design. Put that to death so that Christ, who's the ultimate source of life, can live in you. And then what do your words do? They're not raka or you fool. It's, man, I want to come to the broken. When the Spirit's at work in me, and I'm dying to all my stupid impulses, now all of a sudden my words bring life. And my actions bring life. And in my marriage, there's life. Everything becomes beautiful. And then all of a sudden you recognize, like, this all belongs to God, and he's got a design for it. It's all his property. We're all in his image. Our job as Christians are to be agents of resurrection. Always being advocates of life, always defending the defenseless, always pursuing justice for the outcast, pursuing justice to make sure that nobody is trampled upon unjustly. Like, because, by the way, that's also part of this commandment. There's so much in this. Like, Jesus doesn't just say, okay, use your words well, you know, and don't stab someone. But think about Matthew 25. You know, he's confronting people on that last day, right? And I'm going to paraphrase it because I don't have it up right now. But on that day, he says, hey, you know, when I was naked, you didn't clothe me. When I was hungry, you didn't give me food. Well, what does that mean? Like, you didn't care about my life. You didn't take care of me. You left me to die. And what does he say? Whatever you didn't do for the least of these, you didn't do for me. In other words, you saw me in my life and in my needs, and you chose to turn away from me, to ignore the Imago Dei, to ignore your responsibility as your brother's keeper, or however you want to put it. And you're responsible for that. Mm. On that day, that's a terrifying thought. Like, so life is not just, okay, I'm going to passively honor people's life by not damaging them. As Christians, guess what? You have an obligation in the sight of God to look for those whose life, you know, maybe not in the sense of do you have a pulse, but is your life wrecked? Well, I need to use my resources. I need to use the calling that God has given me to advance causes of life. So does that mean that I donate to the food bank? I donate to the Hope Pregnancy Centers or wherever where they're advancing the cause of life? You have an obligation as a Christian to do that. And so it's really helpful when Jesus kind of gives us not just permission, but an obligation to see this commandment, which is really, and if I were to put a positive spin on it, it's you need to uphold the sanctity of life in all of its forms. You need to uphold the dignity of human life. That doesn't just mean, you know, hey, I didn't kill anyone. But it's I'm bringing about flourishing to the best of my ability everywhere. And I'm making every single human being that is made in the image of God, I'm giving them the dignity that they're entitled to because of how you, God, made them, even when they're really hard to love. You know, if you're like me, when we just went through, you know, what Jesus said and where he says, but I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. You know, that I want to clarify that it is what it says it is, but there's a specific sense of anger that's in that Greek word, which is orgizo. And it's like a wrathful rage. I want to hurt you. I'm coming for you. You are my adversary. And so, like, if you look elsewhere in the New Testament where that exact word is used, it's like, you know, the king was angry and he sent his troops and destroyed the murderers and burned their cities. That's in one of Jesus's parables. Or it's talking about, you know, the in Revelation, the dragon, Satan himself, becomes furious with the woman and goes off to make war on her. That is the sense of this, right? It's the older brother of the prodigal son who is angry, who is wants his brother dead and is sad that he's now come back, right? Like, it's this I want you dead kind of anger. Like, I'm enraged, I'm filled with wrath. But what's interesting is in Ephesians chapter 4, it says be angry. And that is the same word that's used here. That kind of, you should be really outraged at certain things. But then he says, he qualifies this, he's quoting from a psalm, be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your anger. And so even when Jesus is saying everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment, and he goes on talking about that, like, that's terrifying, because I feel angry sometimes a lot where I feel like that's justifiable anger. You know, like when I see injustice happening, when I see, you know, the culture sliding that my kids are going to inherit, like, that makes me angry. Is that okay?
And the anger we see in the world today is kind of that hot, fiery anger that you were describing. Mm-hmm. It feels like more and more and more that we feel that way towards certain people, certain individuals, certain groups. So it is one of those ones where it's like, mm-hmm, almost everything has to be a heart check in that situation, honestly, for each of us.
But yeah, so how do you evaluate it? And that's where I kind of want to land for a moment. There's a great, incredible quote by C.S. Lewis, which pretty much, it feels like anything he says is a great, incredible quote. But I read this and I thought I had to sit on it for a minute, because I was like, is that brilliant? You know, like, I need to think on it for a minute. His line is, anger is the fluid love bleeds when you cut it. Let me repeat that one more time. Anger is the fluid love bleeds when you cut it. And so whenever you're angry, there's a couple of things that you always have to ask yourself so that you can determine whether or not it's godly anger or it's something that you need to repent of. Okay, so here's a couple of things. One, I think C.S. Lewis's quote is really insightful when he says, anger is the fluid love bleeds when you cut it. Everybody who ever gets angry because they love something. Like, right? Like, it's threatened. You've just really hurt, and now I'm feeling angry because you're threatening something I love. You've just cut something I love, and now I'm angry. And so the question is, what do you love? Are you angry because somebody, you know, took away your idol? You know, anger and fear are like metal detectors for idolatry. Whenever somebody messes with your idols, you can count on being either scared or angry. But are you angry for God's sake? Are you angry for the sake of righteousness? Are you angry because you love people and you're looking out for your kids and you genuinely want the best for humanity? That's question one. Or are you angry because it poked your pride? Are you angry because it hit your ego? It hit your little g gods? Are you angry because something that you hold up as a god that should not be a god just got threatened or harmed? Is that what's bleeding? Is it that love for those little g gods that's bleeding? If so, suck it up. You don't get to be angry over that. Like, you need to let it go and forgive that person and it's over with. And like, that's where anger becomes dangerous. And right now our world and our culture is just filled with that kind of anger. It's not looking at the person who triggered the anger and thinking, okay, that person is in the Imago Dei. They hurt me. but I want to bring life to the situation so this angry cannot turn to rage and toxicity where I want to burn them down.
Yeah.
I'm not allowed to do that. Partly because if Jesus were that to me, I'd be a pile of dust, right? Because if anyone was ever entitled to just put me in my place and really scorch me with wrath, like, I deserve it. So because he's shown me mercy for far worse as a believer, now I show mercy to others. That's what we're called to. It's really hard, but that's what we're called to. So the first question is, what do you love? What do you love that's making you angry that it's being threatened? If it's a good thing, great. Like, you should be angry. Be angry and do not sin. Do not go tear down. Do not go set foxtails on fire. Do not, like, don't do that. And then the second question is, or the second part of that is, do not let the sun go down on your anger. Okay, I'm really outraged. I've seen probably 15 headlines today already. I should never be left alone to doom scroll. But I've seen headlines that I think are offensive to God. I think he is angry over these things, and I share in that anger, and I hate the fact that this is where our culture is going, and I'm angry, and I'm, and then what does Ephesians tell us? Part two, do not let the sun go down on your anger. Well, what's the only possible way you can do that?
Dealing with it.
Well, how do you deal with it?
I think it's figuring out what you can control.
Boom. That, for sure, I can't control any of this, so it's stupid of me to get wound up. But there's also another part of that where it's, because I can't control this, I need to give it to the one who can.
Yeah.
And so when you are about to go to sleep, like, I mean, it's Psalm 4. You do all these things so that you can go to sleep in peace. You have to give it over to the Lord. And if it's something that requires anger and vengeance and all that, well, it doesn't belong to you anyway, right? So you give it to the Lord and you say, Lord, I want you to redeem this. I would love for you to bring about a redemption in this, a redemption story for all the people involved. I want you to save these, I don't know, neighbors, political leaders, whoever it is that you're angry at. Lord, I want a redemptive story because they're made in the Imago Dei. Lord, restore them. Restore them. Bring beauty out of this. Bring a redemption story. But even if you don't, I know that vengeance belongs to you. And if there's a punishment to come, it's not mine as an individual to mete out and to say, I'm going to bring the wrath of God on you. Because you know what? Jesus says, no, that's not yours to do. That's not yours to do. So coming off of that C.S. Lewis quote, anger is the fluid love bleeds when you cut it. Well, is that fluid bleeding out of a love that's godly or idolatrous? That's question one. Then, can you do anything about it? You know, if it's in your backyard, go do something about it. If it's within your control, go do something about it. Or do stuff to the extent you can. If it's voting or whatever, like, do something. But the things that are out of your control that are just going to consume you with anger, and by the way, I'm preaching to myself right now, big time, like, you've got to give it over to the Lord.
Yeah.
I remember listening to, again, a Keller sermon, and he was talking about a war-torn region, and there was a guy, gosh, Miroslav Volf, that was the guy's name, and he was talking about, you know, he lived and he had watched all this injustice and mass murders through his country and rapes and everything else. And he says, you know, this whole idea that vengeance, you know, the West wants everything really nice and tidy. It can't imagine, you know, how people want to have genocidal retaliations and all that. Or, you know, they look at God and think, how could God be a vengeful God? How could God ever send someone to hell? And he says, you know, it's only in the Western minds where everything is so comfortable and easy and nice and neat and tidy that you can get upset that God sends people to hell. But over here, the only way we can forgive our enemies who do this stuff to us, the only way that we can move forward is to recognize that we serve a God who will ultimately take care of justice, and that justice can be taken out of our hands to not retaliate. That's the only way that you could deal with a situation in which you watch your wife, your son, your daughter face horrific travesties and not say, I am going to be the one who brings vengeance. The only way that you could forgive, if you have any love for them at all, is to say, I trust the Lord with it. Because it's his. And by the way, they are his, not yours. Hmm. And so it goes back to having the proper perspective that all life belongs to God, that all human life is made in the image of God, and ultimately, our job is to bring fruitfulness and flourishing to the world.
Amen.
And so we're called to die to self so that life can abound, because our Savior, who is the essence of life, came into the world and died so that broken, dying, dead sinners like us could be raised to life. And that's what it's all about. We're people of life and resurrection. So anything that runs contrary to that, anything on the spectrum of life to death, is a sin against the sixth commandment. Amen?
Amen.
And so in our next episode, just as a spoiler, like, this is going to be a two-part episode, because there are so many strands about the sanctity of life that come off of this. I mean, just war and revolution and all these discussions that we've had through history, self-defense and abortion and euthanasia and all of those. Like, we're going to do a separate set-apart episode next week. So, you know, that way we can get into it and parents can be a little bit on guard for some of the stuff that we're going to talk about, because some of that stuff is really heavy. But as Christians, we have an obligation to talk about those things and to defend life in all of its forms. But there's also parts in the Bible where you do have a caveat, like self-defense, you know? It's because, and by the way, this will bleed into a lot of our discussions on just war as well, but it's because humanity is so sacred that there are times where you're required by God, under the authority given to you by him and by governments, to take life for the sake of protecting the sanctity of life. And, like, I mean, really simple illustrations of that would be, you know, if you see a crazed murderer coming into a schoolhouse and he's coming to slaughter children, you have an obligation to take that person down. And if the only way that you can spare life is by taking his life, you have an obligation to take his life, because life is sacred. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And someone breaks into your home and they're coming to hurt your family or whatever, you have an obligation, you have the right, and I would say as a dad, the duty, to protect the life in your house by taking life if necessary, because life is sacred. And so it's not just straight, you know, very obvious, and there's lots of Christians who have all kinds of different opinions about the death penalty is another one. Like, if God is opposed to the death penalty, somebody forgot to tell the Old Testament, because good grief, there's lots of things in the civil law of Israel that required the death penalty. Or in Genesis 9, where he just flat out says to Noah, of him, you know, his blood will be held to account. Well, thank you so much for joining us today as we start the first half of the Sixth Commandment. We're going to come to you next week, going off on all the tangents. That one's, I'm sure, going to make people mad at us, because we're going to be going down lots of different things: death penalty and abortion and euthanasia and just war and self-defense and, like, how do we parse all those very complex, touchy, emotional issues as Christians who have an obligation from God to defend the sanctity of life. So that will be next week. We hope you join us. We want to thank you so much for listening today. And if you have not liked or subscribed to our podcast, we would appreciate it. And just to give you a heads up, we are about to undergo a branding change where we are, because it's just more searchable. But if you don't know what Out of Water is, you'd have no idea that this is a show that walks through the Bible. So we have a new name.
Do we want to say it? Because we haven't technically changed it officially.
Okay. Well, say it eventually. Maybe that'll be a surprise. But don't be surprised where, when you go to download, or it's automatically downloaded because you're a subscriber, when you receive the podcast in 2-3 weeks, probably, there will be a new name. And I guess we'll leave it as a cliffhanger as to what the rebranding is going to be. All right. But know that it's coming. We just want everyone to be kind of prepped that it's not some weird show that all of a sudden is on your feed. It's coming. And we'll leave that as cliffhanger.
It'll make more sense than Out of Water, so you'll know.
Yeah, it's not going to surprise you. It's not going to be like horticulture.
Yeah, we're not.
You'll know that it's us. All right. So anyway, God bless. Have a great week. Bye-bye.
We hope you enjoyed your time with us and you will both subscribe to the podcast and listen regularly. You can find out more about Out of Water, catch up on past episodes, and access show notes at our website, riovistachurch.com/out of water.